Okay, that sounds a little angry.
Yeah, we've got some angry, angry little chickadees there. According to the notes on this particular observation, there was some sort of bird predator like a merlin or a cooper's hawk or a sharp-toothed hawk around, and they were mobbing it along with some other animals. Like, you could hear a crow in the background of that as well. So, angry, angry chickadees. The way to tell if a chickadee is alarmed or upset is when they do the chickadee-dee-dee-dee call.
Yeah.
If there are more than three DDDs, that means it's an alarm call. And depending on the type of predator or type of alarm, they'll vary the number of Ds.
Oh.
So I'm pulling this out of a book I read a number of years ago. But I think the more Ds there are, the more likely, the more alarmed the chickadee is.
Sure. That's Charlie Mitchell. This is, once again, the Season Watch Pod, a production of KAXC. It's kind of the hunting edition, since a lot of folks may be listening to us from their deer stand.
Mm-hmm. Some folks are listening from their deer stand, and we're talking about hunting critters.
Yeah. I'm Heidi Holton, and this week on Phenology, John Latimer, I was trying to find some bird sounds, you know, as you do in live radio, of course. And I said, maybe I could find a shrike. And he's like, no. I mean, I don't think he said that on the air, but you know, that they, it sounds like somebody else responds to them. They're not really making the noise. Is that right?
That's typically true. They're pretty quiet birds, especially like their courtship song. They kind of hide while they're doing it. You can't hear them from very far away. They do have kind of a whistle sound that you can sometimes hear. It sounds like a coach's whistle or like a whistle you get as a little kid, but they aren't much for making noise.
Okay.
They tend to be pretty quiet, but other birds, when they're around, get very loud.
The alarms, huh?
Yes, yes. So we'll be hearing some alarm calls this week of common birds you might hear that might let you know that a predator's in the area, so you can go try to find a hawk or a shrike or maybe a little fox.
I mean, I definitely have had the experience of listening and thinking, is something wrong? You know, like it is too many DDDs or something. But, you know, then I guess I haven't been curious enough to figure out what the heck that is.
But I think that says something about how long we've been listening to bird calls, that even when you're not listening, when you don't know about alarm calls necessarily, you still hear the birds and think, ooh, I think something's wrong. Like, there's some part of your brain that hears that and knows what it means, even if you haven't learned what it means in, like, the capitalized letter kind of way.
This is the time of year, then, these shrikes.
Yes.
Northern shrikes?
Start heading
south. Are
there
different kinds?
Northern shrikes, yep.
Okay.
So there are two major shrike species in North America. The loggerhead shrike, we're on the very, very northern end of its range, and its population has been kind of plummeting in Minnesota. And then the northern shrike, which is the more common one. The northern shrike breeds in the Arctic and then comes down here during the winter months. Let me double check. It may actually breed in Minnesota.
Hmm.
As I do a quick Google.
And John's going to be telling us a little bit more coming up about shrikes, because I want you to kind of try to help me know what to look for.
Yes. And one of the big things about shrike is shrikes are habitat. Oh, yeah. So we're fully in its non-breeding range. So we'll only see these guys in the winter.
Okay.
But yeah, one of the big things to look for shrikes is the habitat. They are really prefer perching pretty openly, like on fence posts, anywhere where there's like a prairie or a field, along with some scrubby brush or a forest. They love edge habitat. So that's where you'll most likely to see them. I've seen three when I've known what to look for. Each of them has been perched right beside a field, like on a fence post or on a small shrub.
If you're listening for the first time, this is the Season Watch Pod, and it is all about what we're doing right here. I'm curious. Charlie's helping me figure it out. And then it is, we describe it as filled with the delights of nature. I mean, John talked about how the deer stand, especially really those early morning hours before the light is coming up and they're, you know, folks are out there waiting. That's a perfect phenology time.
Yeah. I have not gotten into hunting yet. Just the time spent sitting quietly in the woods, Hunters have such a good excuse to just go do that, that when I go sit in the woods quietly, I start getting like, "Ooh, what's that over there?" And then I move and
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, you're kind of describing forest bathing. That seems like a more meditative sort of thing that you might do. And you don't always think of that with deer hunting, I think, because if you haven't deer hunted or you don't know about people's traditions, you might think it's angry people marching in the woods with guns, you know? And it's like, no. They're not going to find any deer if they're marching around. But there's a lot of similarities there to that quieting down. Well, I think we'll take a listen now to John, right, on the shrike.
I wanted to just tell you a little bit about the northern shrike because it is an amazing bird. It's an odd bird that shows up here in the Northland every winter. Not odd in the sense that it has extraordinary plumage or flies in an unusual fashion. Rather, it is a songbird that eats flesh. It actively hunts down, attacks, and kills mice, voles, insects, and even other songbirds. All other birds with such eating habits are relegated to the raptors group, not the northern shrike. It maintains membership with the passerines. Passerines are roughly defined as perching birds that possess vocal organs and are capable of songs. They also have a particular arrangement of toes, three forward and one backward, and muscles that tighten and secure the perch when they sleep. The shrike meets these requirements, but its habit of preying upon its fellow songbirds makes it a bit of a pariah within the order. The northern shrike is a robin-sized bird with ash-gray plumage on the body and black wings and tail. The tail has white feathers along the outer edges, and there is a white patch evident on the wings when the bird is in flight. The head is bisected by a black slash of feathers starting from the base of the beak. The beak is large and black and has a prominent hook at the tip. To the casual observer, it might be mistaken for a more commonly seen gray jay, but the presence of the black colors on the wing and tail should be definitive, for the gray jay only has black on its head. Our northern shrike has many other names across its range: butcher bird, winter butcher bird, northern butcher bird, nine killer, all stemming from its scientific name, Lanius excubitor. Lanius is for butcher and excubitor is for sentinel, a perfect description of the bird's habits. It often perches at the highest vantage point in the area, and when it has captured its prey, it will impale it upon a thorn or barb, sometimes hanging it from a crotch in a shrub, somewhat like the butcher who advertises his goods in his window. Speculation has it that the shrike hangs its meal because its feet lack the strength required to hold the victim while the bird tears away the flesh. Stories of eyewitnesses to shrike attacks reinforce this idea. Rather than strike with the feet as a hawk or owl might, the shrike uses its beak to subdue its adversaries. One such observation involves a field mouse dragged to the surface of the snow, then released so that the shrike might find a better purchase on it. The mouse immediately attacked and sprang at the shrike, driving it back several feet. The shrike was able to parry the attacks using its beak to deflect the advances. Hoping it had gained enough space to beat a retreat, the mouse turned and ran. In two quick bounds, the shrike was on the mouse and, grabbing it by the neck, shook it vigorously from side to side, the way a dog might shake a rat. Pausing, the shrike bit the mouse along the neck and killed it. The hook at the end of the shrike's beak is designed to facilitate the clipping of the spine and works well for birds as well as mammals. One of the long-held beliefs about the shrikes is that they are indiscriminate killers, that they would kill more critters than they could possibly eat. In Africa, there are five members of the family known locally as Fiscals, from their rapacity, which no revenue officer could exceed. Israeli researchers discovered that males were more likely to hang meals and leave them as a display of their ability to be good providers. Female shrikes were more likely to mate with those males who had more bountiful larders. The same may be true of local shrikes. We don't see much of their courtship and nesting rituals in northern Minnesota because they occur on the nesting grounds, and those are farther north of us in Canada and Alaska. So That's just a little bit of information about the Shrike. It should be showing up here sometime this month, and hopefully you'll be lucky enough to be there and report it to me when you do see it, because I would like to know. I used to see them all the time on the mail route, but now since I don't travel so much, unless one comes to my neighborhood, I'm not very likely to see it.
That's our very own John.
I love that guy.
Latimer. And he does want you to reach out. You can leave a voice memo through SpeakPipe. We're going to hear from someone that left a voice memo for us last week. Just find that on your podcast description or at kexe.org on the Season Watch Pod page. Wow, that's so much to know about a strike. I mean, and the words.
I know.
Indiscriminate critters.
And passerine birds. It's another one that I liked. He's going into some evolution there, which I'm always excited to talk about. Yeah, all of our songbirds.
What do you mean? To explain what you mean by that.
So birds descended from dinosaurs, from reptiles, and then, you know, split off into these different groups. One of the earliest ones was when we think about like cranes. Some of those are sort of the oldest groups of birds. But then songbirds are the passerine birds, Passeriformes, if you're going to go into their order. They have some unique adaptations, and they're one of the most specios, they're the most number of species of the order of birds. So they have three toes in front and one toe in back, and they have specialized vocal cords that allow them to make song much more complex, longer, compared to a goose or a trumpet or swan. And yeah, so then these shrikes come along in this group of mostly, you know, seed or fruit, nut, a very vegetarian group of birds. Well, other than, say, the warblers that are insect eaters. And they say, you know what? That mouse looks pretty tasty. Let me catch it, kill it, and eat it. And maybe hang it on a thorn to scare away so that, you know, my mate thinks that I'm cute and a good provider. Just a wild choice by the shrikes. Not that they choose evolution, blah, 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 but a wild choice to go from insect-eating songbird to, well, I got to make it through winter somehow without migrating. Guess it's going to be other birds and mice.
They're definitely predators.
Yeah. In the summer months, you could kind of see how the transition happened, because in the summer months, they are entirely insectivorous. They only eat insects. There are a lot of other songbirds that only eat insects and are here all summer eating insects, and then they leave over the winter to continue eating insects. Shrikes, for some reason, are these insectivorous species that just decided not to leave and made do with what was available. Mice, other songbirds, rodents. And they can take prey that's like much larger than themselves. So a shrike is about the size of maybe a robin. They've been documented killing pigeons, grouse, and then this is a shrike. It has to pick the thing up and carry it to their larder. But they're amazing birds.
Well, we did get a voice memo this week. We're gonna take a listen.
Hey Heidi and Charlie, enjoying the podcast. You mentioned the gut pile watching. I'm signed up as a volunteer with the University of Minnesota put a trail camera on my gut pile, assuming I get a deer, and then sending in the pictures. It's kind of a citizen scientist project they have going on at the U of M. Just thought you'd like to know. Bye.
Thanks, Mike. You can also leave
a
voice memo. Don't you love citizens? I mean, this is what we're talking about, citizen scientists. There's all these projects out there, like the sounds that we hear, too. People recording in the podcast.
Yeah, so I pull a lot of the wildlife sounds from a citizen science, citizen media organization called Xenocanto, XENO-CANTO. If you like Latin, that's a strange sound or strange song. And people all over the world submit them. They're categorized by like species, whether it's an alarm call. It's not just birds, it's frogs, it's mammals. Yeah, it's a really cool database to look through. And then just here, right here in Minnesota, we've got this awful wildlife watching project, the gut piles. And that has fascinated me ever since I discovered it 4 years ago. It's a kind of two-tiered citizen science project. You have the hunters who are volunteering to put cameras next to these gut piles. The cameras take a bunch of pictures and they get uploaded to another citizen science project called Zooniverse, where people like me who don't hunt but are interested in the wildlife can go in, look at the pictures, and essentially, instead of paying God knows how many undergrads to go through and categorize every single image, you get to volunteer your time to go through and say, oh, that looks like an owl. Oh, that is a squirrel. And kind of do all of the data recognition that needs, you know, these are thousands and thousands of images. And they learn so many cool things. Just to give you an idea, they have gone through over 400,000 images. There have been 8,952 different volunteers who have helped identify stuff through Zooniverse. And there are 442 hunters that are contributing photos. It's so cool. And they've learned just fascinating things, too. So we have four different biomes in Minnesota. We have the boreal forest, which is up where you are, up to the northeastern end of the state. We have the broadleaf deciduous forest, which is where I am, kind of makes a stripe down the center of the state. And then prairie parkland, which is out to the far west of the state, kind of goes again in a, it's a very thin strip at the top, and then it gets almost halfway through the state at the bottom. And then there's just this little area right at the top, kind of, you know, where Minnesota has that little blip where it goes
Yep,
up,
the chimney.
you know, the thank you, the chimney, like just a little bit west of the chimney over to nearly the edge of the state, there's a tall grass aspen biome. And so we've had gut piles in all of these different biomes and found some really cool patterns where you think in the prairie, the animals that would discover these gut piles first would be birds, because they have the highest vantage point and it's this open country. But what actually is showing up to these gut piles first are carnivores. So that leads, of course, it's the curiosity hydra, as I call it, of like you learn one thing, but then five more questions pop up. How are they finding it first? Why aren't the birds finding it first? Are they smelling it out? They found that like barred owls and bobcats will like hang out near these gut piles because rodents are attracted to them. And so not only do they get the food source of the gut pile itself, they are also feeding on the scavengers. What? They figured out like the order that the different birds arrive. So like crows, ravens, jays, like the corvids will all show up first. And then like eagles, vultures, those kind of scavengers. Woodpeckers will come a little bit later. Songbirds only show up after like a week. And then pheasants, grouse, and turkey after 11 days.
So are they looking for different things in the gut piles? That's the staggering of it, or is it just that's the timing and how things work? I mean, I'm imagining like a Thanksgiving dinner and like, I want the drumstick going around the table, or I only want white meat or whatever.
This is a great example of the curiosity hydra.
There you
Like, we
go.
answer one question and immediately you're wondering something else. And I don't have the data, I don't know, but that is such a great question. Like, why do they show up at different times?
Yeah. Could be a
Oh,
whole number of
yeah, I'm
things.
so curious.
Yeah. Okay, I've really enjoyed the gut pile talk, and we had at our house we put a trail cam on a gut pile, and I have never seen such a beautiful photo of an eagle, and we have it in our house from that trail
Oh.
cam because wings and it's just beautiful. It's just a great
Yeah.
thing to see, which you don't think of when you hear the words gut pile that it's going to be beautiful what you see, but.
Yep.
I think I've had enough about of the awful. Yeah. So I
You
think,
can find the project before we end. You can
okay.
find the project at offal.umn.edu if you want
Okay.
to contribute.
Okay. But I just need a little bit of can you
Palate
get
cleanser?
yeah, give me a can you give me a palate cleanser, Charlie?
Yes, absolutely. There was this great clip from one of our student reports this week from North Shore Community School that I wanted to listen to.
Hello from North Shore Community School on the North Shore of Lake Superior. My name is Rosalind, and I'm your phenologist for this week. On Thursday the 30th, Miss Rolfe's class was out killing some buckthorn when they noticed that some of ostrich ferns had green fiddle heads that could be seen poking out of the ground. Valerie noticed that 2% of the leaves on the trees and 98% of the leaves are on the ground. On Monday, October 27th, Miss Gallagher's class saw a flock of snow buntings outside of the greenhouse. They counted 16 and watched them fly on the top of their roof and then disappear. On Sunday, October 26th, Miss Urban saw Franklin's ground squirrel that was running around at Hawk Ridge. Sometime soon, the ground squirrels will start hibernating. On Monday, October 27th, Miss Marcon's class watched a squirrel run up a tree and into a hole. Moments later, the squirrel left the hole and climbed back down. They watched as the squirrel went in and out multiple times. They think the squirrel was hiding food inside for winter. As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the phenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Thank you, Rosalind. What a good one.
I'm all for letting your leaves stay, that's for sure.
Right? I mean, it saves you energy on both ends of the season.
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know, deal with all those leaves in the yard, and then you don't have to fertilize in the spring. Plus, Luna moths. Have you seen a Luna moth?
Yeah. Yes, I have.
Yeah. The big green ones with the tail.
They look like a bird to me, not a moth.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. What? It's crazy.
Yeah.
Also, when
like some of our most like beautiful, dramatic moths overwinter in leaf litter.
It's funny because some of these things you see, you were describing this earlier with the birds, the evolution. Like we, you know, we see like a blue heron down by our lake shore, and it's like that looks like a dinosaur to me in some weird way. You know, like it's just like, whoa, what is that? Oh my. But yeah, I appreciate that. I don't know. This is going to be an old person comment, okay? Just bear with me. But
hit me.
I remember as a kid, right? So fun. You did rake the leaves and you jumped in the pile. I don't know the last time you did it, but it hurts. Why would we ever have done that?
I feel like I did that last year and it was fine.
Okay, I must not have had big enough pile and I'm
but
older.
But also, kids are just made out of cartilage.
Yeah,
like,
you're right.
Their bones aren't all like settled in place yet.
Okay.
I'm going to go off on a tangent, but it's going to be a short one.
All right.
Talking about, you know, young people and cartilage. So when I was in junior high, we got this puppy. Her name was Selig. She was my pride and joy. We live kind of on the edge of a bluff overlooking the St. Croix. So there's a big 50-foot drop outside of our yard. And my parents had just taken down the fence they had put up when we were kids to stop us from going over the cliff.
Uh-oh.
And so I was out there with this puppy every time she was out to make sure she wouldn't fall off the cliff. And after weeks of this, my parents, like, sat me down and were like, this is not sustainable. Someone can't be with her every time. Dogs know not to jump off a cliff. That's called foreshadowing. Sure enough, I was curled up on my couch reading the newest Harry Potter book. And I hear my cute little puppy chasing a squirrel. She had chased a squirrel right off the edge of the cliff. So I jumped up and like ran barefoot all the way down to the river and like trying to find her. And eventually like this rustle in the bushes and this tiny puppy jumps into my arms. Because she was a puppy, and made entirely of cartilage, and because there were a few trees that broke her fall on the way down, she was fine. Somehow. We brought her to the vet to be checked out, and she was bruised on every part of her body, but she chased a squirrel off the edge of a cliff, and, like, her bones just kind of bounced somehow. Young people, have it good.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I love that. I was so worried where that story was going.
Sorry.
No, that's
no
great.
Dogs will die in this podcast.
Yeah, I just get you get nervous about that. Like, I don't know if I could take it. Oh my gosh.
No, I'll end it well.
Well, hey, if you have a cartilage story, like what do you want to hear from people on SpeakPipe?
Ooh, okay. I would love to hear any cartilage stories. I love a dog story. Ooh, dogs and wildlife.
Mm, Good one.
If you have any dogs and wildlife stories, send them my way. But remember, no dogs die in this podcast. So don't you dare send me anything where a dog dies. Please and thank you.
All right, let's end this week with the alarm call again. Which, what are we going to hear from?
Yes,
from who?
We are going to listen to the alarm call of the downy woodpecker, which is relatively common. So keep an ear up.
This has
they
been.
They sound so angry.
I know. Angry, angry woodpeckers. This has been Season Watch Podcast, portions of it. The student reports are made possible by the legislative.
The Northern.
Oh.
Yes. The. Ooh, okay. If we're going for the full one, uh-huh. Then it's the LCCMR, Legislative and Citizen Commission on Minnesota Natural Resources.
There we go.
LCCMR.
It was the North Shore Community School this week.
They fund the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund. I think the shorter and easier version, but I'll say the LCCMR one anytime.
Yeah.
We also heard for the black-capped chickadee alarm call. That was from Valerie Heemstra through Zenocanto. The downy woodpecker was from Gabriel Leity, also through Zenocanto. The Blue Jay alarm call was through Danny Sloan on Zenocanto. The white-breasted nuthatch was from Russ Y through Zenocanto. And then, of course, John Latimer, student talkbacks are also through KAXE.
Well, all I have to say this week of talking hunting, hope you get your deer.
Yes. A woodpecker just flew into my window as we were talking.
Oh.
Luckily, it's the one with a screen on the outside. It's
okay,
good.
No woodpeckers died in this podcast either.
No woodpeckers died in this podcast.
Speaking of prehistoric, what they look like too, you know?
Right?
When
especially
you get to
affiliated
see,
woodpecker?
Yeah, when you get to see them kind of close, it's just like, whoa, what is happening here? We've got a little extra today because some fun stuff happened on Tuesday morning when I was on with John Latimer. He was singing your praises. I mean, he always does, Charlie, but about what he learned last week about chipmunks from you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're always singing each other's praises. We get along great.
And
but yeah, this was a fun one for me to listen to.
This,
we thought it would be a good bonus.
Yeah. This story is right up Charlie Mitchell's alley. That's for sure. Last week, we got to hear Andy Try talking about bears.
Yes. Yeah, that was great. And some really good information about chipmunks.
Yeah.
Some things that I did not know. One startling fact is that in a year like this, when we have a massed crop of acorns, chipmunks can gather all of the food requirements that they need for the entire winter in a couple of days. It just floored me. I thought, my God, they spend the whole summer storing away hundreds of sunflower seeds. And if they could go out to my red oak and gather enough energy to keep them through the winter in 2 days, why do they bother? If I were a chipmunk, I'd get me a lawn chair and just sit out and kind of enjoy the sun and think, okay, no problem. Come October, I'll just go out and grab some acorns and disappear. But that's not the nature of the chipmunk. He's going to make sure he's got plenty of food stored up. I wonder if that, yeah, I thought about that after I read that. I thought about that for the longest time. Like, what do they do? I mean, seriously, my dog killed a chipmunk one day and its cheeks were stuffed with sunflower seeds. So I thought, well, how many can they hold? And I dug them out of the cheek pouches.
Oh my God.
Which, by the way, the cheek pouches in a chipmunk run all the way to their shoulder blades.
Oh wow.
I got 93 sunflower seeds out of this one chipmunk. 93.
Okay, so you're rooting around in a dead chipmunk's the pouch and then counting the seeds.
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
That's what science is.
Yeah.
You know, you can't know unless you count them. I mean, I could just look at him and go, he's got a lot of seeds in there, one,
wow,
two, and a heap. But truthfully, yeah, you got to get in there and dig in and count them. Yeah.
Talk about a podcast for the curious. There we go. But John Latimer did it for us, so we don't have to. That's what I'm gonna. That's where I'm gonna go with. I don't need to.
Oh,
do that.
Come on! I want to send me your count.
No.
Don't. You know, I mean, I'm talking about those that die accidentally. And this time of year, really, chipmunks are becoming more rare. They are definitely getting into the ground to enjoy that larder that they put away all summer. And so it's going to be harder and harder for your dog to catch one. But should that unfortunate event take place, don't let the science get away from you. It's a good opportunity to find out things.
No, thank you. I'm still not going to be a part of that.
I love your and John's dynamic. It's so, and like the dynamic that you two just had of John being like, yeah, do it. And you being like, no, don't, is the exact dynamic that I have experienced so many times. Like, you see a cool roadkill.
Well, I was just going to say, so I was talking about this later in the week on the KEXC morning show. And, you know, as you do when you're live on the radio, you kind of, you don't always get things right. And I said that John had counted, first I said the number wrong, because it turns out it's 93, but I said 92 acorns. And
ooh,
in a matter of 2 minutes, three people texted in and said 92 sunflower seeds. 92 sunflower seeds. Like, they all corrected me. And then I was like, oh my, I was totally wrong, because how would they get that many acorns? Even though the pouch goes down to their shoulders, I learned.
Uh-huh.
Still not doing it. Not counting.
But man, that means they were invested in what John was saying, and I love that.
I know. Yep. So I guess you could leave a message on SpeakPipe if you've ever done that, or if you decide to do that, but I don't know if I want to hear that. You do.
I sure do.
I'll close my ears. How's that?
Yeah. I'm delighted by the weird things that curiosity gets us up to.
Yeah.
Like, scientists turn out to be just the weirdest, which I love. Like, there was, in grad school, I worked on turtles. And, like, turtle hatchlings, when they come out, they, like, find their way to water. Because the eggs are laid on land, they hatch, and they need to find water. And so they were trying to figure out the answer to how do these hatchlings find water, because their eyesight isn't very good. But they were trying to eliminate a visual cue as an option. And so some scientists spent hours designing tiny, tiny little hatchling turtle blindfolds and putting them on these, like, quarter-sized little turtles. And then releasing them and seeing if that messed up their ability to find water. And this is just... Mm.
It's a masquerade party. You got your little
yep
blindfold on.
I think that's where the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came from. They just, like, finally cut holes in the eyes.
There you go. Wow. Yeah, tell us something weird. Do that on SpeakPipe. We would love to hear from you. Thanks for tuning into this little extra bit of the Season Watch pod. It's for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. And you can also sign up for the Season Watch newsletter. That's a lot of fun as well. You can go to kaxe.org. Until next week, Charlie.
This is always great. Thanks, Heidi.
Thanks. Season Watch podcast is made possible by the listeners of KAXE, People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org.